Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on March 19th, 2019. This is the eighth week of our Tuesday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Magga Vibhanga Sutta, the Buddha's analysis of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So we're at the third week of our 3 weeks on the Eightfold Path. I don't know what chapter we're in, maybe the fifth or sixth. I think it's the eighth week of our Tuesday class. We started out with learning about Shamatha Vipassana meditation method, the only method the Buddha taught. And we learned that he taught that meditation for deepening concentration. That relates directly to this part of the Eightfold Path. Then we studied the Satipatthana Sutta and the Buddha's instructions on how to establish mindfulness of the breath as a meditation practice, and then how to apply that ever-increasing level of concentration to support the refined mindfulness to hold in mind other specific themes of the Eightfold Path, not as meditation practice, but as a way of developing a mind rooted in ignorance to a mind that understands, is rooted in wisdom. Then we studied the Four Noble Truths in a general way, and now the past 3 weeks in a very specific way, the Fourth Noble Truth, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, the self-inflicted suffering that comes from a lack of understanding. This sutta is the Buddha's analysis of the Eightfold Path, so it's not speaking only to the concentration factors, but I'll touch more on that. But this is just it's a sutta that fits nicely in our Dhamma study, but it's also something that we can always refer back to if we have any confusion as to what we're doing as Dhamma practitioners. These are the Buddha's words from 2,600 years ago on how to practice, how to develop his Dhamma. And I was reading through this, as I usually do a few times before I teach a class, even though I've taught this quite a few times. And it just struck, and it starts out with laying the scenario, which is something that's common, even the introduction, the Buddha was at so-and-so, and there he did this. But these words are still ringing true. They're still as powerful, still as useful and practical as they were 2,600 years ago. We can literally put ourselves in the place of that original Sangha and listen to the words of an awakened human being. I have heard at one time the Buddha was staying in Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed those assembled. So this is a formal teaching as opposed to many of the suttas are more spontaneous and given in response to a question or a situation. This is obviously a formal teaching where the original Sangha is gathered to hear this formal teaching. There he addressed those assembled. Friends, I will now give you a detailed analysis of the Noble Eightfold Path. Listen mindfully. This is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So by using the term right, there's an implication that there is such a thing as wrong view, wrong intention, etc., etc., etc. We could use the words appropriate and inappropriate in a chain interchangeable with right or wrong or skillful or unskillful, but right and wrong gets to the point. But the reason why I'm saying that is this isn't, we shouldn't look at this in a moral way, but as a practical way. If we're engaged in wrong view, we're simply going to continue our own ignorance. But if we look at developing right view as a framework for our Dhamma practice, which is why right view comes first in the Eightfold Path, then we'll keep our minds inclined towards being mindful of what we must be. And the same thing as we hold in mind right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Holding in mind, meaning using these teachings or these skills, another way to look at that, these are skills to be developed. Look at these skills as a way of framing our Dhamma practice, but our moment-by-moment life. Is that clear? So that is, again, the utter simplicity of the Buddha's Dhamma can get lost because of our own complicated nature of seeing things. We want to continue to see things as complicated. That reinforces a self-referential ego self, moment by moment. But the Buddha's Dhamma is practical and direct. And it's just this, right speech, right action, etc., etc., etc. I'm beginning with right view. The Buddha continues. And now he's not just going to leave us out there saying we should all have right view or we should all have right intention. He describes it very clearly. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress. When the Buddha describes an awakened human being, he describes it in just those terms. An awakened human being has a profound and penetrating understanding of the nature of stress. Right view is knowledge with regards to stress. It's knowledge with regards to the origination of stress, relates directly to the Second Noble Truth. Knowledge with regards to the cessation of stress, reference to the Third Noble Truth, and knowledge with regards to the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. So you could summarize that as saying that right view is a profound and penetrative understanding and the ability to hold in mind four noble truths. And by inference, you could say that it's also teaching to let go of anything that is not, as far as our Dhamma practice, anything that is not four noble truths. That's just as important an underlying aspect of what the Buddha's teaching here. Remember, that there was just as much distraction during the Buddha's time in the original Sangha to adapt, accommodate, and embellish the teachings even of that awakened human being that's sitting right in front of you. People still wanted to do it. Their ego still had the best of that. So the Buddha just related right view to the Four Noble Truths, and he concludes that by saying, this, friends, is right view. And what is right intention? Being mindful of the intention to recognize and abandon wrong views. Pretty simple and direct, isn't it? If you're ever confused about what am I doing here in Dhamma practice, I'm doing what I'm doing, beginning in a useful and practical concentration practice to be able to hold in mind and recognize wrong views initially. And then to develop a way of living that is resting in right view all the time, meaning seeing the Four Noble Truths clearly. Is that understandable? Is that clear?
Yes?
Yes? Please say yes.
Yeah.
If it's not, please say it's not. It's not?
Okay.
Excuse me. Again, everything the Buddha taught was in context or to develop understanding of these Four Noble Truths and nothing else. The Buddha continues, being mindful of the intention to remain free from ill will. That's related directly to the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path that we reviewed last week. Again, we want to know how to incorporate our behavior into the Eightfold Path. It's right there. And you could say that all of the virtuous factors and virtuous behavior taught in the Eightfold Path can be boiled down to just remaining free of ill will towards oneself and others. That's the essence of right speech, action, and livelihood, isn't it? And the Buddha points out certain variations on that, but it all is set in that framework of remaining harmless towards oneself and others. Being mindful of the intention to remain harmless to all beings. This, friends, is right intention. Nothing ambiguous about it, is it? And what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from abusive speech, abstaining from gossip, and abstaining from idle chatter. And in other lessons, other teachings, and usually in my teachings, I'll point out the other aspects, like right speech is speech that is necessary, that it's likely going to be useful and not fall on deaf ears. If we know that what I'm saying is not going to be heard and taken to heart, not being useful, I keep my mouth shut. And especially if what I'm saying isn't really necessary. And that those two often go hand in hand. It takes a little bit of wisdom to know when something is necessary and when it's not. It might be the most important teaching in the world, such as just the straight Dhamma. But if someone isn't ready to listen to it and incorporate it, it's the essence of wrong speech to even speak it, speak of the Dhamma. In fact, the most important application of right speech, action, and livelihood relates directly to presenting the Dhamma in an authentic and straightforward way. And there's other suttas where the Buddha says, if you don't know how to do it, keep your mouth shut. In fact, I think it was last week's Dhammapada, might be 2 weeks ago, where the Buddha says just that, that you shouldn't be teaching the Dhamma until you know what the Dhamma is, which makes sense. Of course, that was common during his time, that people held themselves out as teachers simply because of an idea. This, friends, is right speech. And what is right action? Abstaining from taking life, abstaining from taking what is not freely given, abstaining from sexual misconduct. This, friends, is right action. And what is right livelihood? Right livelihood abandons dishonest livelihood. Right livelihood is honest livelihood. Pretty straightforward. This, friends, is right livelihood. And what is right effort? Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to avoid unskillful qualities that are not present. A lot of words to just say, we become mindful of our behavior, and our behavior is then framed by the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path. And we're holding that in mind. And in the beginning, it truly is a training in moral and ethical behavior. Because I've yet to meet an awakened human being, I've yet to meet a human being who didn't have to be mindful of their behavior, at least to a certain extent, no matter how, to use the word, saintly they may be at the moment. We all make slight compromises. Sometimes people are, their behavior is very egregious, but most of us, it's really those subtle, as a Buddha would say, the wise know the danger in even the slightest deviation from the Dhamma. This is what the Buddha's talking about. It's important to not beat ourselves up, but it's as important to be mindful of hurtful behavior towards ourselves and others, to recognize it and abandon it.
John, will you read that one more time, right effort?
Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence. You've got to keep going. To avoid unskillful qualities that are not present. So this is the beginning. This is one aspect of that. Thank you for asking. The Buddha is teaching us to be mindful of certain qualities that have not yet arisen. Why? So we can avoid them. This is where we're starting. It's another way of the Buddha's brilliance in allowing us to start a Dhamma practice wherever we are. He's not saying that you need to be pure, or you need to pay for all your past sins, or you need to have some kind of exorcism done on you before you can start the Dhamma. I'm saying that because in many ways there's some schools that teach that. They teach a purification practice before we can actually start Dhamma practice. The Buddha never taught that. We start right where we're at. And just be mindful to not continue to develop hurtful behavior from this point on. That's where we start.
And the only way to really see hurtful behavior that has not yet arisen is actually to look outside and see what others are doing, because you know it's not yet arisen, so it's not something that you can see in yourself. I think he wants us to look out into the world and see what is happening there.
And also he's given us a framework to start with right here, right now. Mm-hmm. The qualities that I want to avoid are wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. And I know specifically because the Buddha's teaching, right? Even those don't need to be ambiguous, although in our minds we can make it so. It's right here. You know, I have to be mindful of it. And what happens if it comes up? Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to abandon unskillful qualities that are present. So again, look at the brilliance of it. The Buddha's first starting where you are. No matter what type of behavior, notice it and avoid anything new coming up. Then the next step is to recognize the behavior that's occurring right now. Patterns of behavior that you have that must be changed, not to appease the Buddha or the gods or the devas or anybody else, if you want to develop awakening. Because a mind that is still rooted in ignorance and acting poorly as far as their behavior is a mind that is incapable of awakening. It doesn't have the framework to look at itself and abandon that hurtful behavior. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
So simple direction, and no reason to not understand it, is there? Anybody can read this and take it to heart and develop it. Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to establish skillful qualities that are not yet present. Again, it's a lot of words, but just encouraging us to continue to develop our behavior within the framework of right speech, right action, right livelihood, And then because of that foundation, we can now deepen our understanding of right view, right intention, and expand on the concentration factors of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And we cannot do that. We can't incorporate and deepen our concentration practice if we're not also looking at our behavior. Why? For a very practical reason. If we're not being honest with ourselves about our behavior, our minds will simply be too distracted by being caught up in our own unskillful behavior. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. It's impossible to develop a meditation practice outside of this entire practice. Now, I know of many meditation, so-called meditation practices that work very well to distract us away from what we need to change. And it brings a measure of calm because of its increase in ignorance. But that's all. There's nothing helpful about that. There were a couple of hands.
Yeah. I just wanted to get back on that expression, not yet arisen. I see now it just means not yet.
Not yet present, yes.
Not yet behavior, not yet something you're doing, but you can feel the tendency in yourself.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, and we can practice. One of the key tenets of the Buddha's teaching is to understand and implement wise restraint. We went through that series, I think, 5 or 6 talks just on that. And again, a self-referential ego personality, this is called the ego, doesn't want to hear that word, does it? At no time does an ego want to hear the words restraint. An ego is commissioned and compulsed to never practice restraint, to always be grasping at more, to always be looking to establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs to it. It doesn't want restraint. So another way of saying that is the problem with anatta, not knowing self. It's the problem with self-referential views. It's the problem with self-identifying with all phenomena. So the counter to that is to recognize and abandon that type of self-centered behavior, selfish behavior, ego-driven behavior. I-making. And all that it means is to recognize that I am just one of these 6 properties as the Buddha teaches. I don't need to ornament myself in any way to be a valid human being. In fact, when I feel like I need to, I'm lost. Mm-hmm. And again, that's the restraint that the Buddha's teaching. And Andrew brought up something related to this, and many people do, because the implication is if I don't keep promoting myself and establishing myself in the world, what's going to happen? Peace will happen. Because it's a self-referential ego self that is always striving for more and is always setting itself up for distraction and disappointment. It's never in its body.
Always becoming.
And what are you going to become? If your mind is rooted in ignorance and distraction, the only thing you can become, because your mind is driving it, is more ignorant and more distracted. You may have the most successful life outwardly as any human being ever lived. You could be, you know, a successful real estate developer and become president of the United States. It doesn't necessarily mean that you've developed any inner calm. And that's, again, I'm just using, that's a very handy example, and probably too easy to, you know, low-hanging fruit. But he's not, I mean, I'm not, again, there's a lot of people like that. You know, it's just a good example. Yeah. So not a lot of peace and calm, not a lot of happiness there. And I've known, when I was in the construction business, it seemed like the most unhappy clients that I had and almost impossible to make happy through my work were the wealthiest ones. They seemed almost to a person to be the most difficult ones to work for. And they seemed to want to make the job even more difficult than it was at times. And I'm not making a blanket policy against all rich people. They're bad. That's not the point I'm making. But position, power, money never establishes happiness and usually can't.
Well, the unhappiness is actually used. I see that often in my work too. People make a point of pointing out their unhappiness because that's what makes them important.
Yeah, and usually, while they incorporate their unhappiness as a part of a blame game on you too, even, you know, somehow you're responsible for
right.
it. it might just be because of a position to take. But again, that's all self-referential, self-induced suffering, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Buddha's teaching it. So, excuse me. Let me say that once more just to get it back into context. Right effort, excuse me, is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to establish skillful qualities that are not yet present. Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to end confusion and increase the full development of skillful qualities that are present. Again, I talk often about recognizing what has developed. What are you holding in mind as your Dhamma practice? And that's what the Buddha is referring to here too, to recognize the developments, the increasing concentration, the increase in refined mindfulness, the increasing ability to remain present in your body, no matter what's occurring. To notice that and build on it. Build on it by being mindful of it. And I would say even giving yourself a little impersonal pats on the back for it. Really, it's important. This is also an aspect of being gentle with ourselves, acknowledging the benefits of our own behavior and our own dedication to the Dhamma. It's very important. This, friends, is right effort. And what is right mindfulness? Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the body, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful, and of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. Again, a mind united in its body. What's occurring right now? Is my mind reacting? Abandon it, not analyze it, just remain free of it. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of feelings arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. That's the second foundation of mindfulness. Right? We don't do anything else with feelings. We don't analyze it. We don't embrace them. We don't do anything with them. We notice that we're caught up in our feelings. Come back to the sensation of breathing. That's what ardent and alert and mindful, abandoning greed in relation to the world. Greed in relation to the world would be a clinging to our feelings in an analytical way, or even just letting them drive me to more, I want more of what's giving me this pleasant feeling. And our minds are lost then in meditation, aren't they? We're just thinking about more. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of mental qualities arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. Again, with thoughts arising and passing away, I simply come back to the sensation of breathing. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the quality of mind arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. This, friends, is right mindfulness. Anybody have any questions about that little section on right mindfulness? It relates directly to the four foundations of mindfulness, but then off our cushions as well. When we find ourselves distracted by feelings, by thoughts, or by attaching the two, a thought attached to a feeling is an emotion, especially if it's a harsh judgment, it gives rise to something. Simply recognize that we're caught up in it. Our minds have reacted to a feeling or a thought or a combination of the two, and come back to the sensation of breathing. And we do that at any time. And that, according to the Buddha, is right mindfulness. Again, nothing too confusing about it, is there? And what is right meditation? For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and they withdraw from the need for sensual stimulation. So when you find yourself, your practice is developing that, even if it's just a mild inclination to not be distracted in this moment, you recognize that you might have gone towards distraction in the past and you practice restraint. In this moment, I am not going to be distracted. That's a concentration practice. And recognizing what you've used in the past to distract yourself and abandoning that is important too. Or even to do it in stages. Many people are addicted to social media. Especially today, they're starting to recognize it as a real addiction in some circles. And so the solution is not necessarily to stop all your tweets. If you can, go ahead. But it's to recognize for yourself, and again, just using it as an example, that you're preoccupied with your tweets or your Facebook posting, etc., whatever it might be, and ask yourself, is it necessary to do this? And let that question that you're asking yourself start whittling away at distracting and unnecessary behavior, whatever it might be. Why? Because it'll bring you peace of mind. It's a direct concentration practice. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and they withdraw from unskillful mental qualities. What is an unskillful mental quality? It's all been taught here. Anything that would lead to adapting, accommodating, and embellishing the Dhamma first and foremost, and then any type of behavior that's not well framed by those virtuous factors. We know immediately what we're doing in this practice. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and they enter and remain in the first jhana, the first level of meditative absorption, which is joyful engagement and pleasure in the Dhamma born from withdrawal and accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. So again, the Buddha's teaching us very practically how to evaluate our own practice. Have you all entered and remained in the first jhana, even if it was just momentarily?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's almost a day-to-day thing.
Yeah, you're doing it right, by the way. And there's nothing extraordinary about these different levels of meditative absorption. Every meditator who does this practice correctly will experience each one of these levels of meditative absorption. It's just by following direction. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and their directed thoughts and mindful evaluation quiets. They enter and remain in the second jhana, the second level of meditative absorption, which is joyful engagement and pleasure born of deepening concentration, free from directed thought and mindful evaluation, and confident within or inner poise. Everyone has experienced that, even if it's just momentarily?
Mm-hmm.
That's the second jhana. Again, nothing magical or mystical or unachievable, but it's important to recognize it. And it only the direct experience of this first jhana, second, third jhana, fourth jhana only increases, but it's important to recognize it as we're developing. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and their joyful engagement fades. Equanimity arises with mindfulness of pleasure in a mind united with the body. In other words, as we go through this ever-deepening levels of meditative absorption, we first take pleasure. The first jhana is noticing, recognizing the pleasure simply born of seclusion, simply born of having an authentic meditation practice. It feels good to start being mindful of the breath, especially after a long, busy day, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that recognition of the joy of seclusion might only last for a moment or two for many of us. That doesn't matter. What is important is recognizing that it happened, that it occurred. And when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, come back to the sensation of breathing. And this time you might find yourself, feeling joy simply because of your practice. That's the second jhana. It's no longer just seclusion. You're taking pleasure in a well-concentrated mind. And why shouldn't you? It's your mind. And it's a remarkable achievement even to develop momentary concentration, because that's more than most every human being that's ever lived is able to do, because they don't have the right method. And then we continue in our meditation practice, and even that joy born of concentration fades away, and we are enjoying a mind resting in calm and peace or equanimity. Has every one of you experienced that, even if it's just for a moment or two?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone?
Yeah.
Nobody hasn't? That's the third level of jhana. Ram?
Mm.
You're too hard on yourself. I know you have. The Buddha's pointing it out and teaching this in this sutta to remind us to recognize that, yes, this is doing something that my mind never would have experienced if it wasn't for this practice.
Mm.
And then the fourth level of jhana, let me read it. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases, their mind rests in equanimity. Neither pleasure nor pain have a footing. They enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Their mindfulness and equanimity is pure, free of wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So the fourth jhana is simply a ever deepening level of the third jhana, isn't it? It's more lasting, it's more profound, but it only deepens. You remember the I can't remember the name of the sutta where the Buddha used Sariputta as an example of right meditation, and how Sariputta kept declaring to the Buddha, I know that there's an even deeper level of concentration than this, referring to the different jhanas. And even when he got to the fourth jhana, he told his friend and teacher, the Buddha, that yes, I know that there's even ever deepening levels of jhana here at this point. So the fourth level is simply a level of pleasant abiding that is unwavering or equanimity, but yet we continue to meditate. I got a question a year or two ago from an online student who asked me that question. Why did the Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? And I had to think for a couple of minutes because it never was asked that. It put me back on my heels. But the answer and the truthful answer was because he enjoyed it. Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't anybody who has developed concentration to that point want to meditate? Where this person, and the question says a lot, he saw meditation as a burden to overcome to get to a certain point rather than this most expedient tool that we use to deepen concentration. Right. This, monks, is right meditation. This is what the Buddha declared. Those gathered were gratified and delighted at his words. That's the end of the sutta. So it's just a simple and practical instruction on how to integrate the Eightfold Path. Does everybody see it that way? And does everybody see it as a good sutta for further reference? In other words, something, you know, one of those things you might, I don't know, hang it on your refrigerator or something, or come back to. Just to, especially in the beginning, but even later on, just to remind ourselves, this is what we're doing in this practice. If we don't get off track and get into other things. Very simple and direct. Let's go online first. See what's going on with Mary and Russ. Wait a minute. And Helen. Hi, Helen. Hi, Russ. And Jane is good, too. How are you, Russ? How are you, Helen? Uh-oh. We had this problem before. I don't know why, Russ. I can't unmute your phone. Helen, can you, you have anything to say? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's wrong. Jane, you have anything? Can you say something? I think there's a problem with the mics. Yeah, I don't know. All right, I'm glad you joined. Matt, how are you tonight?
Good, very well. Thanks for giving this teaching tonight. Very, very clear. Very direct. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Good evening, Lorna.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
The last few weeks, I think the Buddha's made it very clear that, you know, that we have to be careful and be mindful of ourselves before anything else. It's all about ourselves and how we deal with ourselves and our thoughts and our feelings, and I think that's sort of come across very clearly. Regarding my own practice, I think I'm getting more skillful at not taking the bait when you have a situation in life that your anatta arises and you want to defend yourself or press your own feelings onto somebody or something like that. I think I am getting more skillful at that. And not only that, I can see the wisdom of not taking the bait, meaning it's eventually kinder to myself.
It is, yeah.
If I don't have that arising. You can see that it's you stay in a better place as well.
Yeah.
That's kind of the best way to describe it, I think. So I think I'm on the path, you know, just developing slowly. That's fine. I would like to give a shout out to Matt's class on Saturday. He took us down the path and the order from the, is it Taoism you refer to, the path of the Taoism belief system from the Big Bang to when we come into existence and go out of existence to the point that we're worm food. I mean, he went right there. And as he explained the pathway through time to how we've come around, how we've come about, you could see there was no point in history that we became a self. If you wanted to believe in and see yourself as a self, you would just literally have to just like put your finger on the map and say it started then. But it would not have developed to then. You were just like putting it there.
Fabrication
is a good word for what I'm trying to describe. But you could, it was just wonderful, wasn't it? I mean,
it was great. That was really.
Yeah, it was wonderful. So I just wanted to say it was, I have never been disappointed in Matt's classes, and you know, that was one of the best. It was just, and then another thing, from that, when I've been meditating, I've trying to see myself as just the six properties.
That's
I'm
very profound.
Miles away from that. I can't.
But you're considering it.
I'm considering it and looking at it. But I know I'm miles away from it, really. You know,
We touched on that a little bit too on Saturday.
Yeah. So, as I say, I've just been kind of thinking about it in meditation and things. But, and I know it's fact, but to actually think it to the point that you can feel it and believe it is something else.
It sounds like it speaks to the impersonal but impermanent nature of not a self, but just human life.
Yeah.
Mm.
So maybe we got to figure out a way of either doing it specifically up there on retreat or something else, but
okay.
Sounds important.
Mm. It was very good.
I'm sorry, were you done?
Yes.
Thank you. You mentioned the world's bait. That's the translated word that the Buddha uses often to recognize and avoid the world's bait, because that's really what it is.
Mm.
It's really, and it's what it was like this during the Buddha's time, but I think maybe even more so, it's geared towards, the systems in the world are geared towards attracting greed in people, mostly.
Definitely.
And that, because it's the great distraction, isn't it? What do I need? And so the more restraint we can practice, the point I'm making is, and recognize the world's bait, to just what you were describing is how to practice the Dhamma, to recognize what I'm getting drawn in again. Tomorrow's sutta, you may all want to listen to this, is called the Lokavaga, which relates directly to the Loka Sutta, where this whole section of the Dhammapada, one whole chapter, is geared towards recognizing the benefits of recognizing and abandoning worldly entanglements. There's a great little 10-line section. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ram, good to see you.
Good to be here. Going through this sutta again for the third, fourth time, I just realized how much more time I really want to spend on just plain studying, reading through it, because every time there's another detail that gets cleared up.
Every time. I'll use you as what I'm going to talk about right now. You showed me that book before.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like an interesting book. And we should look, part of right effort is studying what is likely to develop. And how do we know until we read something first? There's some things that we know are supportive of the Buddha's Dhamma and those things that aren't. And we should be mindful of that, about what we're going to spend our time in. So it's kind of a backhanded way of saying you might not want to read that book, but what I'm really saying is to leave some time for actually studying what the Buddha taught.
Yeah.
For that reason, because I've been at this for a long, long time, and every time I read this, I get something out of it that I didn't see before. It's just remarkable. Thank you. Mary has joined us too, so let me at least say hello. I don't know what's wrong. Hi, Mary, I'm trying to unmute your phone, but I can't do it. So if you can on your end, if Helen, Russ, Jane, if you can unmute your phones and want to say hello, that'd be a good time. I don't know. Mary? Yeah, I know what's wrong. Hold on a second. I think I turned somebody snuck in here and turned the volume all the way down. I think it might have been David Dada, but go ahead, say something. Anyone, say something. No?
Hi, John.
Hi, Mary, how are you? Well, let's start with Mary. How's your Dhamma practice, Mary? How'd you enjoy tonight's talk? Oh, I lost it again.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
It seems like there's a delay.
Okay, let's...
I can hear you.
What do you got to say for yourself, Mary? Say hello to David anyway.
Hi, David.
Hi, David. There must be a pretty big delay, so who knows what's going on. Let's continue to go around the room. David, good to see you.
Thank you for teaching, and I have nothing
to add. I'm glad you're here tonight. Kate, good to see you.
Good to see you. I noticed last night, like, a practical benefit of this practice. Just a quick story. I went out to dinner for, like, an hour and a half, and got out of dinner and looked at my phone, unfortunately, and I had, like, an absurd amount of emails from work. Like, too many. Totally overwhelming. And it was all, like, stuff needs to be dealt with right now, this is important, tonight, blah, blah, blah. And at first I was, like, really stressed out, and then I kind of got angry a little bit. Like, I felt myself getting, like, angry.
Yeah.
Like, it's 9 o'clock, leave me alone. I don't want to be doing this anymore. So my normal thing would be to just, like, start going at it and just working. And last night I just was like, no, I'm gonna sit down and I'm gonna meditate first for 15 minutes. And I even, like, had the thought as I was sitting down, like, this isn't gonna go well because I'm just not in the right spot, and, like, my brain's going a mile a minute, I have too much to do, I'm gonna be thinking about everything I need to do, like, the whole time. And it ended up being, like, a total surprise because it was one of the best sessions I've had so far. And I was, like, shocked. I was like, why? I'm so distracted, and, like, I should have been elsewhere, but I was there last night, and when I was done, I just felt so much better, and I thought, like, well, that's, like, a way to handle it again when it comes up, because, like, I'll just go do that again. I don't know. It's, like, it just hasn't happened yet, and it happened last night, and it was, like, really encouraging, and I kind of was, like, I just, like, saw the benefit so clearly.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Thank you, Kate, and thanks for bringing that up. And also, it is important that you recognize that, and it was successful because of the work that you've put in already, the foundation that you've done, and it's just like that. Now, you'll probably have some meditations in the future that don't seem like that.
Yeah.
But the important thing is that you just keep doing it, and in general, I would bet you're finding that you're just more calm and well concentrated in general.
Just in general, I found that it just, like, immediately, like, put a stop to where I was going with it, which was, like, I was getting angry and frustrated, and it was going to just spiral out of control, and it just stopped it in its tracks. And then I was in a different place when I was done.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah.
Isn't that remarkable? Mm-hmm. What you're describing is you were recognizing that you were going to lose your mind in the next moment, and you didn't.
Right.
You are in control of that. Mm-hmm. That's remarkable. Thank you for sharing that. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. To be back here. I don't think I have anything to add. I'm just taking it in and be present. Thank you.
Glad you're here. Andrew, good to see you, as always.
Well, I concur with Ron that every time one hears, again, these descriptions of the milk tooth, that one picks up something additional, mm-hmm. and no matter how often I hear it, it's always valuable. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you for being here and sharing that. I wanted to ask Kate, you really get it that it is this eightfold path. That's what we're developing,
mm-hmm.
and all the other suttas are supportive of developing the path and understanding of Four Noble Truths.
Yeah,
that's it. That's mm-hmm. the context for Dhamma practice. So. I'm going to give you guys one more chance to say something. Jane, you got something to say? And if it'll work. Hi, Jane. No. Hi, Mary. Hi, Helen. Hi,
John. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now. How are you? Oh, there's still got to be a delay.
This is Jane. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. We got some audio issues, I think, tonight. So I'm glad you could join.
The broadcast is very distorted tonight.
Yeah.
That power cut, remember?
Yeah, we did. We lost the power for a little bit. I actually mm-hmm. lost the feed. We'll see. I hope it was useful enough. I'll have the audio recording posted a little later tonight or early tomorrow morning, so you can try that. But we'll finish with Metta.
No, it was very useful.
Good. All right, we'll finish with Metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for joining tonight.
Thank you, John.
Peace.
Thank you, John.
Good night, you all online. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.